You're listening to the Wine Country Live Morning Show with Barry Martin
on KVON Napa, 1440 AM at KVON.com.
And I am happy to welcome to our studio the interim police chief for the city of Napa, who's been on the job a couple of months, I think now, Sylvia Moore. Am I pronouncing your name right?
Pretty close, Barry. It's okay. Moyer.
I knew there was an extra syllable in there somehow. Sylvia, thanks for being here today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Barry.
So give us a little scene setter about you to begin with. You have been in policing for your entire career?
I have. Over three decades in uniform, the majority of it serving right here in Northern California.
Mm-hmm. And tell us where and when.
So I served in the Sacramento Police Department, which is an incredible organization, a learning organization that serves a very diverse community. And I served in the Bay Area in Menlo Park for a short period of time. And I was the chief of police in El Cerrito for just over 5.5 years.
Mm-hmm. So different environments, very different from Sacramento to El Cerrito, I would think.
Sure. I think you take a big city perspective to a smaller organization and influence where you can. And then when I retired from El Cerrito, I served in the Tempe, Arizona Police Department, which was really a unique experience, not only being in another state, Barry, but being in a college town again. It was enriching, invigorating, complex, and grueling at times, but very, very rewarding.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you get connected to come back to Napa for this particular function, interim chief with a sort of sudden resignation of the previous chief and all that? There's not a whole lot of people, I wouldn't think, who are suited for that kind of work.
Sure. The position of the interim police chief is unique because it is typically given or awarded or really bestowed on someone who has experience as a police chief, that is in good standing, that can rapidly recertify or amplify their certification with the California Peace Officer Standards and Training, and come in for a short period of time into an organization until a permanent chief is identified. And so how that path was for me, Barry, was that I retired in late October in Arizona, and I was dabbling in a few things, a few passions of mine, and I received a phone call. And I knew of Napa. I knew of Steve Potter, the former police chief and current city manager. And Steve and I started engaging in some conversations where he described the needs of the community, the needs of the organization, and then vetted me as a candidate to come in for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. And what does a short period of time mean? I think when we talked with Steve Potter some months back, it was undefined. It was a period of months.
Well, that's one of the difficulties, right? It's one of the opportunities and challenges. It's undefined. And really, there are some parameters, of course, that are governed by the California Public Employee Retirement System, because I'm a retiree. I can only work a certain number of hours mm-hmm. per fiscal year. Mm-hmm. And it's very strict in that regard. But Steve Potter was very clear when he asked me to analyze and evaluate the organization, to then contribute to the organization. He recognized that I'm not a show horse, I'm a workhorse. And he said that the right candidate would be here for a number of months to assess and evaluate. And then I identify, what does this community want and deserve in their permanent chief, and then guide that process moving forward? Were we going to go for a national search? Do we have a right and capable candidate internally? So he's given me a lot of latitude, but very clear guardrails in terms of evaluating the organization. So when folks ask me, how long are you going to be here? I don't know. But I'm doing absolutely all I can in the time that I'm here to contribute and to make the difference that is expected of me by the community in Napa and the officers in this organization mm-hmm. and the professional staff in the organization.
Mm-hmm. What have you perceived is what is wanted by those different interest groups, the community, the members of the police force themselves?
Well, I think every professional staff. Every sworn officer wants something similar to the community. There's a disconnect in how we talk about it. My perception is we want the same thing. We want employees that are treated with dignity and respect, that they make decisions internally with fairness, that they're given voice, that we are transparent and impartial internally. So that translates into how officers engage in the community. The community, as I have understood, and it's not uncommon, they want the very same thing. They want voice, transparency, fairness, and impartiality in the way that they are policed. And to really elevate reform efforts, to elevate the way that we safeguard them. Uniquely in Napa, one of the primary complaints, and giving voice is not just about expressing opinion. Giving voice is different. However, in Napa, folks are very concerned about traffic and what traffic intensity means for this community. And there are a host of other concerns, of course, Barry, but that is a big one that I hear about quite a bit.
Yeah, for sure, especially the pandemic starting to wind down and the resumption of traffic. And I'm constantly being reminded, yeah, it was bad before the sure. pandemic. It's getting bad again. Interesting. However, traffic is an issue for everybody. Every resident, no matter who or where, thinks that the traffic moves too fast on their street in front of their house. I've learned that over time. But when you came into this position, we were in a very different place and mood, and the focus was not on traffic. It was on police brutality
yes.
or excess use of force, and people were calling up a lot of incidents from the past in Napa that may or may not have involved those issues. What's the conversation been like inside the police force on those topics? And more importantly, did you perceive a problem in that regard when you started?
Well, I can say that police chiefs across this nation have been grappling with reform efforts and strengthening policing for the entire time I've been a police chief. I was appointed police chief in California in 2010. And so in my nearly 11 years, we've been grappling with this. It's just been amplified. I can say that our cause is permanent, our methods are flexible. And what I mean by that is our cause is we are the peacekeepers, we are the peace officers, we are the gateway really to this larger criminal justice system. We're the uniform presence. We in many neighborhoods are the only resource 24/7 for folks. So there is, and there is a lot of conversation about, are we the right and correct societal actor to handle the many issues that have been thrust upon the police? And most executives would say no. However, we also have conflict about if we're not the right societal actor and we are rapidly removed without another appropriately trained, funded, and placed societal actor, then what does that mean for marginalized communities? What does that mean for communities where we are the only societal actor? So police chiefs, I included, we are concerned about the rapid removal of police from certain neighborhoods. We are concerned about what it looks like at the other side in terms of the service that we deliver. Internally in Napa, the men and women are open to what it might mean. And I've seen that. I've heard it. In the community, when I entered, there were groups that were kind of forming and creating some change. And I took over some of those efforts to engage with the community and give them voice and hear what it looks like to be transparent and accountable and fair in the way we deliver service. So we're continuing those efforts. I could say that the method is flexible, and the men and women of the police department in Napa have demonstrated their willingness to do what is right by this community.
We're talking with Sylvia Moyer, who is the interim police chief of the city of Napa for an indefinite period of time. In terms of this search process, one of the obvious questions when somebody's in the position you're in is, are you a candidate for the permanent job?
Totally fair to answer to ask that question, and I'll answer it with this. No, I'm not. I have served over 32 years in uniform, and I think I'm better served being behind the scenes and really helping the next generation prepare for the rigors of the work, prepare for the way that the work is delivered, and to question the flexible way in which we deliver that work. So I am not. But I'm absolutely committed to doing my part in the brief time that I'm here.
I want to loop back to the beginning for a moment here for you. When did you come to a decision that you wanted to work in law enforcement? Did you come from a law enforcement family? Was there any situation or event that sent you in that direction?
Well, Barry, now you're asking for the real story. So while I come from a family that I had an uncle that was with the Oakland Police Department from 1949 until the 70s. He was extraordinary, but I never imagined myself as a police officer until I went on a ride-along with a Sacramento police officer in North Sacramento, and she exposed me to what it looks like, the texture and complexity of policing in that environment, where she was tough as nails, but compassionate and empathetic. We had foot pursuit, and we had some other high stakes environments and calls for service. And she was also compassionate with a woman who lost her husband of many decades. And I said, this is the kind of service in that moment, in that shift where I rode with her. I knew this was what I wanted to do. I wanted to put myself in a place to safeguard people. And that was 1986. Which is scary to say, Barry, but it was an absolute calling, and it has been extraordinary in this. I can't even believe it's been this many decades, quite frankly.
You strike me as somebody who's eager to go to work every day.
I am. I am because I believe in being a peace officer. I believe in how we safeguard people. I believe that in the central nobility of the work, and that is people that are willing to sacrifice self to be in a space with others. We don't always get it right in policing. We don't always act in accordance with our values as a profession. But I would say largely the national narrative around police officers does not really align with how we identify with ourselves. The humility of the work, the constitutional foundations in which we operate. And I could say that I have been enriched by recognizing that the acute, chronic, and cumulative toxicity of the work, we need to do better by the individual actors who are police officers, because there are a lot of folks that are suffering because of the service of policing. Mm-hmm. And we have a higher responsibility to insert humanity into them, practices into them, so they can then demonstrate those as they carry out their service. It's not light or easy work, Barry, but it is absolutely gratifying, meaningful, and what I deem noble in mm-hmm. terms of our society.
Mm-hmm. And to a lot of people, maybe impossible. The work that we have laid out for law enforcement officers in the modern society, maybe not true 50 years ago or 75 years ago, a very different job. What it is today, a lot of people compassionately will say, no one could succeed in doing all of the things we're asking police officers to do without making mistakes ever, without losing their temper ever, and so on and so forth. How do you respond to that? The idea that this job is really four or five different jobs, and maybe it would be better if other people did some of those specialties.
I do not disagree with that assertion. And as I referenced earlier, many of us have recognized that we are not the right societal actor to handle the array of issues that have been laid at our feet. I also believe that we have a responsibility, as I referenced earlier, to identify those right societal actors, to work beside them and have a safe and peaceful transition for the folks that need the service. And until those people are in place, until those professionals are in place, then it's irresponsible for us to remove police. I would say that we recognize that we in policing are the reflexive muscle of the government, quite frankly. And that's how a lot of this happened. There's a need, the government responds, they insert the police 24/7. People that are passionate about serving people and caring for people are going to do whatever we need to do. So we said yes. And we said, we stood up against some that wanted us to be inserted into some things. There was no other option. So we said yes. And I do think we have a responsibility to continue to examine those spaces where, used as a reflexive muscle of the government into these complex and failed social net, we have to reweave it and identify who are the right people to handle the problems that are before us, because they're far more complex than one group of people, and those are police officers. And really, Barry, when we approach the issues that are before us, we come with tools and training and education that are very different, and it's not as vast. It's also not as specific as folks deserve and folks need.
Some people will point to the amount of training that is typical for police officers and, you know, describe, for example, well, you're expected to be sort of a soldier, sort of a psychiatrist, expert in various technical things, and you do that in 8 weeks or something, or 16 weeks.
22 but okay. Okay. Yes.
Unrealistic, right, to think, sure, that you can learn as much as you need to learn. What do you think about that? Should there be a movement toward a different kind of education for law enforcement?
There are models across the globe that might inform the way that we train and educate. I see training and education is very different. Training is to a skill, and education is really to this different level, this different breadth and depth of a body of work. The California Peace Officer Standards and Training is widely known as the best in the nation. However, they have barriers and funding issues just like every other body. There are a number of unfunded mandates that are thrust upon police departments and agencies of every size, NAPA to LAPD, struggle with how do we pull officers out of the field in order to train. And there are struggles, and they are real. There is a lot that would inform the way that we train and the way we educate. The next wave, I think, is really understanding how neuroscience informs the way that police officers engage in times of crisis. So let me give you an example. I understand that the Greeks said that our brain is like we are in a chariot holding the reins, and it's being pulled by two mighty horses. The one horse is that emotional side ruled by our amygdala, that fight or flight that is informed by all the things that occur. The other is that rational horse, that rational side that's trying to pull us to the other side of the road. What we're seeing across this nation, Barry, concerns me, because what it is, I believe, driven by our amygdala. And our amygdala, I'm not a scientist, so any brain people out there, I hope you don't get mad. But what I understand as a novice is that neuroscience has to inform our amygdala is getting hijacked. And we're seeing this over and over, where police officers go into position where their amygdala is overriding their rational brain. And do we blame them as human beings for being afraid? Do we blame them as human beings for being hijacked? We shouldn't, but we are. We give them no grace for the mistakes that are made. And we need to train so that the rational brain, that horse that's trying to pull us to the other side of the road, is respected, valued, and cultivated. That we have practices, training, and education that helps police officers in this complex, high-stakes environment in which we operate, helps us do it better. And then I would say the other piece, quite frankly, is we really need to look at the absence of compassion. We need to cultivate compassion throughout a police officer's career, because we've seen instances, and the Derek Chauvin, George Floyd tragedy to me was an example of an absence of compassion, absence of humanity. And that is, it is jarring for all of us that witnessed that.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Interim Napa Police Chief Sylvia Moyer. We're going to take a brief break here for some important things. We're going to come back. I'm so glad you can stay a little while longer. I'm just getting warmed up. I've got a long list of questions and topics, and you're touching on so many important things. Thanks for being here today. Back with more in just a moment.
You're listening to the Wine Country Live Morning Show with Barry Martin.
On KVON Napa, 1440 AM at KVON.com.
And we're talking in this hour with Sylvia Moyer, who is the interim police chief for the city of Napa, having a conversation about all kinds of things related to local policing and the policing in general, the bigger picture. One of the issues that I keep coming back to and doing talk radio in this last year, there's been a lot of policing stuff to talk about. What I keep coming back to over and over and over again is why there can't be, in this era of so much technology and so much understanding science and everything, some non-lethal options beyond the taser, which we know is not 100% effective, and you know, just having a taser has not prevented there from being shootings that don't seem to be necessary to the quote-unquote necessary, depending on your position. Why has there not been some progress in that regard?
So, Barry, thanks for asking this question. I think we first must start with the character training and education of the individual police officer that is tasked with identifying the threat that's before them and then appropriately responding. So if we ignore that, we can add all the technology in the world and it won't make any difference. There is technology that's showing great promise. There's a remote restraint device called a BOLA wrap that really is two barbs on an 8-foot Kevlar cable that's discharged from a mechanism that wraps an individual. It is wildly successful in terms of being a remote restraint device. It's also a device that is not 100% effective. The taser has been proven over and over in a touch stun capacity or a deployment at distance to be effective, but not 100%. I think what you're calling on is a bunch of folks to identify what are the array of issues that are before police officers and to fill the gaps. And that is not light or easy work. There are tools, but I would say that we first have to train the police officer in the array of rapidly evolving complex environments in which they operate. And I would say that there are folks that are attempting to identify technologies to disrupt the emotion, amygdala hijack of the person that the officer is confronting. And many of those folks are challenged with mental illness and are under the influence and not rational in terms of the way that they are interacting with a police officer. So it's about people and technology working well together and us as a society recognizing that nothing is 100%.
Mm-hmm. You touch on the fact that many people who end up interacting with police are under the influence of something. And these days, a lot of meth is involved. And then there are, you know, harder things, too, that send people off into sort of fantasy world. There was a guy in town the other day. I actually saw him twice at two different parts of town, down here in the south end and the north end. And he was so agitated and tripping on whatever. And I just knew he would have some kind of involvement with police before the day was over. Sure enough, the next day I saw the report that he had been picked up, you know, no surprise. When you talk about compassion, there are a lot of people who say, you know, just shoot those people. You know, they're kind of a waste of life the way they're living anyway. What difference does it make? You know, and anything that you would, as a police force, do to that kind of person, they deserve it. How do you counter that? That's not necessarily a thought of the police. That's a community thought that exists. How do we get away from that kind of thinking?
Well, I'm not a psychologist. I would say that we are in the business of humanity, and there are folks in our society that kind of operate on this broad spectrum of behavior. I don't share that thinking. If I did, I would not be worthy of or have the character worthy of being in this office with the authorities that I'm given as a peace officer. I would say that we recognize that the first casualty of policing is our compassion, that we need to cultivate compassion. The circumstance that you just described is scary for people because a person that's agitated because of mental illness or rage or emotion or drug use, that's scary for a lot of folks. And what you just described takes me back to what we talked about a while ago, and that is that are the police the appropriate societal actor to engage with that individual that you just described? I think many of us would say no. We enter that encounter, which I haven't heard a crime that was occurred in this description, this scenario that you gave. We are likely not the right societal actor, but at current time, we are the only. And we bring specific tools, which connects us to the technology conversation we just had. And that is we bring certain tools, certain character, certain authorities to that interaction. And those are the interactions where there's not a defined crime, but we are in the business of public safety, in peacekeeping, and we are the only societal actor, and we trust our officers. We train and trust our officers to engage with someone like you just described quite frequently. And the majority of the time, they do it with compassion and precision, so it's never seen the light of day by the broader community. So to answer your question about what do we say to those folks, I say, well, you and I differ. I believe in humanity and compassion and doing right by people, and sometimes that is tough and ugly, but I'm in the business of safeguarding people and reducing harm.
Mm-hmm. The word compassion has come up a lot as we've talked here, and it's an easy jump for some people to say anyone would be more compassionate and more connected if they weren't in that car all the time. And you go back to in small towns like Napa, why don't cops ever walk the beat like they used to? You get acquainted with people, you talk, you interact. The only place I've ever really done that is New York City, where there's still cops on the street in the, you know, heavily populated areas. They aren't necessarily interested in having a conversation with you, but at least you're seeing a human being and, you know, you're interacting in some fashion. Why is that so out of fashion?
I think the majority of that is some of the measures in which we use to rate the efficiency and effectiveness of modern police in a city like ours, and that is response time. Folks talk about response time. How long did it take for a police officer to get to my call for service? How we measure effectiveness is not compatible with modern policing. It's not always compatible with the desire that you just expressed. And cops report that if they are walking the beat, then they have to get all the way back to their vehicle to respond to a call for service. It has a couple of different influencers. One is this measure of response time, which I reject quite frequently. because it causes cops to speed and causes them to stay in their car, right? And a number of other things. The other is that we don't have the overlay of staffing that's a place like New York has. The East Coast is staffed at a very different level than West Coast policing. And while I can't cite the numbers right here as we're having this conversation, I can say that to have, you know, one cop per thousand is not out of keeping with the norms back east, but it's very out of keeping with West Coast style policing.
How did that happen?
Well, I think some of it has to do with the cost of policing. The cost is extraordinary. To look at public safety broadly, police and fire, is very, very expensive. And communities and our elected officials and our city governments, we make very tough decisions regarding funding and budgets. And quite often we recognize that a great percentage of our budget is consumed by public safety. So there are trades that occur. It doesn't mean that roads and parks and other infrastructure is and social services are not important, but there are really tough decisions that have to be made.
There's been a lot of talk in recent times during this period of focus on reform that one way to change things would be to reduce or eliminate protection of from liability that police officers have as individuals. If you talk to people in policing, you're going to get a very different response to that than you do from maybe the general public or people who are advocating for it. And one of those responses that you'll hear is, well, you're not going to be able to hire any new cops in the future if you have that hanging over your head all the time. What are your thoughts about that liability issue?
There are a number of folks that misunderstand it. And unfortunately, I think what we're seeing is an epidemic across our nation of intellectual laziness, maybe lack of inquiry, believing a soundbite without inquiring further. And Aristotle said the mark of an educated mind is to entertain a thought or idea without accepting it. And so, well, that goes back to my college days, and I'm sure one of my philosophy professors would be totally jazzed I just said that. I think it really reflects where we are. We're a society of sound bites, and people aren't inquiring. And what this is saying about these liabilities, it doesn't protect a police officer wholly. It doesn't wrap a blanket of financial security and legal security around them, because the protections really say that there's a carve out if an officer, police officer, has acted outside of the law, they're not protected. So I encourage folks to dive into these arenas and ask more and educate themselves before they assert or react to a soundbite that has been provided. We have a lot of folks that are demonstrating some real reaction and energy around what they hear others say without diving in to really understand it. And what you're talking about is qualified immunity. And if one was to look at qualified immunity, I think they'd understand that it doesn't just give wide permission for police officers to act outside of the law, but it does offer for protection for those times when there are mistakes that are made. And in this human endeavor of a human police officer engaging with another human in a time of crisis, because let's admit it, Barry, we don't get to engage with people when they're not in a time of crisis, that in this high stakes environment of loss of life and loss of trust, qualified immunity gives some assurances that if I make a mistake, that I'm not going to lose everything for which I have committed my life to build.
And you know that, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, I think the simple fact is mistakes do happen. And unfortunately, in the soundbite world we're living in now, you end up in this situation of, well, the cops shot another black person. And for some people, that's all they hear, and there's no nuance to it whatsoever. Here's a clip of video showing the person being shot. Well, how about the video from the minute before that, or 2 minutes before that, that we don't see? It's happening so often now, and we spend 12 hours super focused on it, and then we move on to the next thing. I think that, in my mind, that's contributing to the problem. It's not really shining light on problem. It's contributing to it, the mistrust issue. Do you think that's true or false?
Well, there are a lot of things that inform my response. One is that I know the loss of life prematurely and out of tragedy is a matter of significant emotional consequence for everyone involved. And I would never minimize the suffering with that that comes with that tragedy. I would also say that in our nation, there are millions and millions and millions of face-to-face encounters between a police officer and a member of the public each year that there are a couple of things, and I know folks are going to say, I encourage you to listen to the end of this response before you react. And that is that there's such a small percentage that go just really wrong. But folks react and respond, I think, quite emotionally and often appropriately to the difficulty that comes with a police officer and a member of the public having a fatal encounter. And we in policing have to have a reckoning with where we have not appropriately acted, appropriately responded, appropriately intervened, or appropriately safeguarded the humanity of the person on the other end of the conflict. We have to have moments of reckoning. Broadly, we've done that. We have done it in communities, in local moments. It is not enough. And we continue to walk forward. We continue to do the work where we recognize we don't always do it right. And we have not always treated people with dignity and respect. So we recognize that. We have to have our moments of reckoning around that. We have to be transparent and be held accountable to that. And we have to do better and do right by communities. And as an executive, I have to do right by the men and women in the organization that are carrying out the very difficult and complex work. And that takes a variety of forms that through strategy and policy and the organizational culture and climate and the other things to really cultivate men and women that have a heart for service, to insert humanity, to give grace and receive it in the very few times it's given back to them. And this is not easy work, but we are doing the work, and we're doing it in a way that is full of character, full of values, and full of just genuine care for people.
I'm going to wrap it up right there. That was a great conclusion to our conversation. I have 14 other questions. I could probably go on all day. This is such a deep topic. And
it is.
I really appreciate your time and your frankness and your approach to this. Sylvia Moyer, interim police chief for the city of Napa. You're going to be around for a few more months for sure?
I am. I think I will be here through the summer. Thanks, Barry.
Okay, very good. Well, I hope to talk with you again.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
You bet.
You're listening to the Wine Country Live Morning Show with Barry Martin
on KVON Napa, 1440 AM and KVON.com.